Well, good morning, Tuesday.
Wow.
Sun is coming up over downtown Detroit. It was a spectacular night last night.
And it turned out to be great weather-wise because we had rain in the morning, but then the evening, it was nice. It was a nice breeze, I understand. It was very nice. Different from last time when you were down there.
Last year was sweltering. I don't know what bread feels like when it's in the oven when it's baking, but that's probably what it felt like last year.
Yeah.
This year was chef's kiss. It was beautiful.
Gotcha.
Absolutely beautiful. Sunny and cool, and there was a little bit of a breeze. It was perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely perfect. And there are those moments, I feel like, when you are in the midst of the hustle and bustle.
Yeah.
And there's so much going on in your life that there are those small moments, those little tiny moments that you're like, oh, it's perfect.
Perfect, yeah.
And I had that last night. We saw Marie. Jamie was down at the fireworks. So we saw Jamie and Ryan, her husband Ryan, and a bunch of people down there. It was cool seeing everybody. And then we decided to go back to the car before the fireworks started.
Okay.
And watch from there.
Because you had a view from there as well.
We had a great view from where we parked.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, guys, we got to, once the last firework had shot off,
we
are
out
of here. We got to go. But we're sitting there watching the fireworks, and I just look over to the kids, and they're just like,
yeah,
mouth open.
Uh-huh.
Fire. You could see the fireworks, reflecting in their eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a small thing.
It was that little thing. So it was very cool. Credit to Tony Michaels, his whole crew
and
at the parade company.
And the Zambellis. Oh, my God.
I mean, just everything that they do for the city of Detroit is, there are very few people that are better stewards of this town than Tony Michaels and everything that he does. And it was another great night last night.
Well, President Donald Trump is endorsing Republican Congressman John James in his campaign for Michigan governor, calling him an American first candidate who will deliver results for the state. Now, in a post on Truth Social, the president praised James as a West Point graduate, combat pilot, Iraq War veteran, businessman, and member of Congress, saying he has a complete and total endorsement and will not let Michigan down. Trump said James would focus on cutting taxes, reducing regulations, boosting domestic manufacturing and energy production, strengthening border security, supporting veterans, and protecting gun rights. James, who represents Michigan's 10th congressional district, thanked Trump on social media, saying the endorsement is energizing his campaign and pledging to lower costs, improve public safety, and increase election security.
I think that this is not a surprise to me.
No.
I mean, just think about it strategically. Does it make sense for Donald Trump to endorse somebody who was not an ally in Washington?
It really doesn't.
I mean, it makes the most sense.
It does.
He would endorse John James.
But I know one person may not be too happy this morning.
Well, I think there was a lot of people that aren't happy.
Yeah, but one in particular.
Who's that?
Perry Johnson.
I think Eric Nesbitt probably is not happy either.
No, and I know he's not happy because he decided to drop out. He has suspended his campaign just hours after the president endorsed John James. And Nesbitt announced on social media that he's ending his bid and joining Trump in backing James for Michigan governor, calling for party unity heading into November. His decision reshapes the GOP primary, leaving James, former Attorney General Mike Cox, and Perry Johnson still in a race ahead of the August primary.
It felt like, look, Eric Nesbitt's a good guy. Like Eric Nesbitt.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Dude.
Yeah.
It felt like they were just holding on to see what would happen.
Yeah.
If Donald Trump was going to endorse him or not, or any of these, whoever.
Yeah.
If Donald Trump was going to make an endorsement, that might have swayed where their campaign was going to go.
Exactly.
But with the way things have been going, Eric Nesbitt kind of running behind much of the pack.
And, you need campaign, money to continue your campaign. And when you have someone like Donald Trump who's endorsed one of the candidates, that candidate, I'm sure, will be getting more campaign donations, and the rest of the party will energize behind that candidate because it's a Trump candidate. And
whether it's a Trump candidate or not, I mean, there is a rallying now around John James.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, Tom Leonard drops out. He supports John James for governor. Eric Nesbitt has dropped out. Now he is supporting John James for governor here in the state of Michigan. So that's, you know, two former foes that are now on in your corner. So interesting. But I imagine there will be more coming. But, you know, you've got John James, Mike Cox, and Perry Johnson kind of in a pack, depending on what kind of poll you look at.
Republican U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers is demanding that Democratic hopeful Abdul El-Sayed stop calling him a pharma lobbyist and alleging a $14 million payout or face a defamation lawsuit. In a letter from Rogers' legal team, El-Sayed is ordered to cease and desist from making the claim, which Rogers says is false and damaging to his reputation. Rogers says he has never been a registered lobbyist and calls the accusations a whopper of a lie. El-Sayed, a candidate in a competitive Democratic primary, has repeated the criticism on national interviews, arguing Rogers benefited financially from the pharmaceutical industry and has taken large donations from it. His campaign says the claims are based on Rogers' financial history and political record, while accusing Rogers of trying to silence him ahead of the general election. Rogers' attorneys are demanding a response by today, escalating tensions in what is already shaping up to be really closely watched Michigan Senate race.
Yeah, certainly. Meanwhile, Dusty May out at the University of Michigan. Dusty May taking a head coaching job in the NBA, and he will be coaching the Dallas Mavericks next year.
And you know, I don't. It was just like a wind whip when I heard Dusty May is out. I don't know. It's just like, what? You know, and like you said, you're not really surprised. I just think, you know, the timing was a little... gave me a little whiplash a little bit when I heard.
First of all, I understand why coaches maybe don't want to coach in college basketball anymore.
Yeah.
It feels like a tremendously unneeded weight.
Uh-huh.
Because you're essentially recruiting your players after each practice. Right, it's just at any point anybody can be like, "Oh, I'm transferring. I'm going to put my name in the transfer portal. I'm on out."
Right.
You know, so it's a different world. But look, Dusty May wins a national title at Michigan. You know, there was this new contract extension that was offered to him.
Yeah.
Signing it, didn't sign it, whatever.
I don't know what that. Yeah, because it depends on who you listen to.
Correct, and now he's going to Dallas to coach in the NBA. I think he'll be a wonderful coach in the NBA. I think, Dusty May is a great, great basketball coach.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just think, listen, when you are at a high like Dusty May, I mean, you know, your stock is very high right now. And so you take a look at everything. That's all I'm saying. You just take a look at everything.
But, you know, the other thing, too, is I think there was a time in college athletics where if you won a national title, you could take a minute to do a victory lap.
Uh-huh.
Right? You had a minute to maybe go on a quick vacation to Bermuda with your wife and kids.
Yeah.
Now you can't. I mean, those interviews that we did, or the interviews that we had heard from Dusty May after the national title game was, you know, we're right back at it. Landed, now we're looking at film and we're seeing who.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, is that what you want to do?
Yeah. And I think it's just different now than it was before, where you could take that time and do that. But now I don't think you can. And so it's just different.
So you've got an opportunity now to go to the NBA and maybe get an opportunity to enjoy those kind of wins.
Yeah.
A little
more.
And
the Mavericks are, you know, they're a good team.
Good team.
Yeah.
Good team. I would not want to be out west.
No.
At this point in time.
Well, OKC in San Antonio.
Yeah.
Get ready.
Lucas Tomlinson of Fox News joins us on the other side. What's the latest on the Strait of Hormuz? Is it closed? Is it open? We'll find out. It's JR Morning. So there is some movement through the Strait of Hormuz. We're not back to pre-February levels.
No.
But things are starting to move a little bit as Iran says the waterways close because Iran is not vacating Lebanon, southern Lebanon, as part of this memorandum
Israel.
Of understanding. Excuse me, Israel mm-hmm. not vacating Lebanon as part of this memorandum of understanding. And so on one hand, you've got the president trying to balance the Israeli issue.
Yes.
Being that they're kind of doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of need to be a part of all of this to make it
to
work.
To make it happen, yeah.
Meanwhile, the Iranians are saying they've closed the Strait of Hormuz, not effectively, but It creates a bit of a problem and a contrast for the president that he's got to deal with. Let's talk to Lucas Tomlinson, our Fox News reporter. Lucas, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Well, good morning from the White House, guys.
Okay, so let's talk about the Strait. What is the status of this right now? And what is this the hotline for the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, this all comes after the Vice President J.D. Vance was in Switzerland negotiating with the Iranians for over 18 hours over the weekend. He just flew back yesterday, and the Vice President claimed that Iran was going to let U.N. nuclear inspectors into the country to take a look at some of those sites, particularly perhaps those that were bombed by U.S. and Israeli forces. He also said there were going to be some deconfliction mechanisms put in place, that any potential quarrels or skirmishes in the Strait of Hormuz would be settled via hotline, a phone, and also ceasefire mechanisms. You guys mentioned Israel in southern Lebanon. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his forces aren't leaving. In fact, overnight we saw these videos emerge from the Israeli forces showing these underground tunnels with all these rockets inside them, and you know, thousands of rockets have been raining down on northern Israel in recent months. Not in the last few days, but Israeli soldiers have been killed, about 5 in 48 hours. It was quiet yesterday, but just as I got on the phone with you, I heard from a colleague in Israel saying that the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, got into a firefight this morning in southern Lebanon. So it's a very tenuous ceasefire. And of course, this memorandum of understanding that President Trump signed at the Palace of Versailles last week, in point one, includes Lebanon. And that is a potential major sticking point, because it's very clear Iran wants to link Lebanon and its forces, Hezbollah, its proxy forces, to this overriding ceasefire to help bring this war to an end. But it could be very, very difficult.
Lucas, when it comes to the Strait, how much leverage does Iran still possess here? I mean, even if the waterway is technically, you know, technically remains open, can Tehran still influence oil prices simply by just creating uncertainty?
They sure can. And you heard from President Trump when he sat down with our own Brett Baer at Fox News in Beijing, saying all Iran has to do is threaten to close the Strait, threaten a drone or a missile strike, and it wreaks havoc. We have seen millions of barrels of oil coming out of the Strait in recent days, although I would say how much of that is Iranian oil. We saw major sanctions relief yesterday from the Treasury Department after we heard the announcement from the Vice President saying Iran had allowed these inspectors in, which, by the way, today Iranian state media and its foreign ministry spokesman saying we didn't agree to that. There aren't inspectors coming here. So that's very interesting. One day after the Vice President's announcement. But Iran is saying they can put they're not calling them tolls. Of course, they're being very cagey with the language, but they're now talking about insurance. You have to buy this, you have to buy that. And Iran still has a lot of leverage over the Strait of Hormuz. And again, this sanctions relief is bringing billions of dollars into Iranian coffers. And some are claiming, experts, that you know, the IRGC, the Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, those sanctions have been relaxed. So you remember we heard the Vice President here at the White House just a week ago saying Iran would not be getting any money up front.
Right.
We read in the Wall Street Journal editorial page say that looks like that is not held up.
Meanwhile, the United States partially lifted sanctions on some of the Iranian oil exports. I'm curious to know what that would mean going forward. Are these talks progressing in a positive way? Because the president says, look, if things aren't going well, if they're not behaving, then we'll do what we have to do.
Right. And President Trump and the Vice President being clear, they want to see gas prices go down. You have to tell our good listeners in the Detroit area that, you know, the midterms are coming up, and it's the one economic figure we all see driving around. We all get that. And it's very clear that the motivations at the White House are the best thing the president can do for the American people is to bring down the price of gasoline, because if the Republicans get clobbered in the midterm, the Trump agenda will be on thin ice. The Republicans have got to hold the Senate, and that's why officials here really want to see the price of gasoline come down. That's why you saw this memorandum being signed, and really, we've heard from some critics, a lot of money up front for Iran.
Interesting stuff as always. Lucas Tomlinson, keeping your finger on the pulse. We appreciate you. We'll talk again soon.
I appreciate it. Hopefully those Tigers can start winning some
games.
Know.
Oh,
what's going I know. On
there? Your lips yes. to God's ears, Lucas. Thank
Our
you.
Our Nats are surprising people.
Right, that's right. Guys. That's Lucas Tomlinson at Fox News. We appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Lucas.
But again, I think this shows you how tenuous the situation is.
It is. And you know, we talk about the oil prices and everything, but then there's a military, I believe, dimension in here as well. Because, you know, if there's just one incident involving a tanker or a naval vessel in there, that could just reignite things and get things bad, too. So, you know, we need to find out what we're doing here in the Straits and who's, you know, who has it open, who has it closed. We're hearing people talking on both sides. We don't know.
No.
You know, really, we don't.
No. And the reality is, again, you don't want to give too much leeway.
That's right.
Right? Just from That's a right. power position.
That's right.
So some of the things that they have to consider. We'll take a break. More coming up on JR Morning. Well, here's your chance to win a trip to see two country superstars in Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan in Las Vegas. Double the hits, one unforgettable night, and we've got your flights, hotel, and concert tickets covered. The Double Down Tour, Aldean and Bryan co-headlining with special guests John Pardee and Chase Matthews, all live under the neon lights. Prizes provided by BBR Music Group, Texas Hours, national keyword, Georgia. To 95819. That's Georgia to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please do not text and drive. Official rules and more info at WJR.com. Big country guy?
I love all music. And country music, I think nowadays, is different from the country music my dad used to listen to.
Yeah, it's a little different.
A little bit more. I don't know.
It's a little different. I asked Brian one time if he liked country music, and he's like, no. No. He's like, I grew up on real country music and I hated it then. Look at him nodding his head like a bobblehead back
Just
there.
Putting the baseball cap don't make you country.
Cowboy boots don't do it for you?
And the cowboy hat,
no,
man?
No, nothing? They don't do it
no,
for me.
Okay.
What if they have spurs on? Does that work? No.
I'll tell you about real cowboys when we're done.
Okay.
Was a real cowboy.
Terrific. The UAW is worried about some of the direction maybe that some of their factories are going under. And it's a new age of robotics.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a lot of automation
seep
into our factories, and it's made the car building process much more streamlined.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there is worry that people could be replaced by cobots, and it's part of our topic for Mobility Makers today. Sam Fiorani is Vice President of Auto Forecast Solutions and joins us this morning. Sam, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
So what are cobots, and why is the UAW all worried about it?
Well, cobots are collaborative robots. They work with people, and alongside them, there's no need for protection between the robots and the workers. It allows the process to work faster, work more efficiently, but it is designed to work with people.
Well, and Sam, you know, Detroit has lived through automation waves before. How does today's AI and robotics revolution compare to the introduction of industrial robots, let's say, in the 80s and the 90s?
There's going to be a time when robots will take over most jobs in the assembly line, and it has been transferring that way since the 70s. We're seeing more and more factories built around robots as opposed to with people. If you look in China, you'll find the factories that are virtually absent of people.
Mm.
And that's going to be the future at some point. Right now, we're trying to keep as many people on the assembly line as mm-hmm. possible. And cobots allow that to happen, but when the robots themselves can do everything on their own without a human being near them, then that's the next step beyond this.
And the worry here for the UAW is that they're going to lose control. They're going to lose workers. They're going to lose their sway with the automakers.
Absolutely, and that's definitely the direction everything is going. When you have robots building everything on the assembly line, you don't have to have lights on in the factory. You don't have to worry about smoke breaks or food breaks or bathroom breaks. You just maintain the robots and keep them going. So the idea that these machines will take human beings' positions eventually is definitely a problem for workers, for the union, and partially for the economy.
And, you know, the UAW, they helped secure these significant wage gains in these recent contracts. I'm thinking, you know, higher labor costs could actually accelerate investments in automation.
That's the whole point. The idea that a machine can do the same job at a lower cost, and it's going to happen eventually. But the workers who are there now have to balance the idea of making a living wage with being outsourced to a machine. It's a problem that we have with the industrial age, and it's nothing new. It's been going on for 150 years that we've seen machines taking over human capital.
What's the AI tie-in with these cobots?
The idea is that they learn, that they can do things that a human being can do, that they see the mistakes, they improve themselves, and can learn from every source, not just what's on the assembly line, but from each other. It's a great plan across all industries, that we can improve the factories, improve knowledge, but there are certain things that humans do better, and we just need to focus on what they are and keep people on the lines doing that kind of work.
And Sam, I'm wondering if automation eventually would create maybe some new jobs inside of factories, you know, robot maintenance or programming or systems manager, or, you know, will those opportunities be limited?
No, there's always going to be that. We've seen that all along. Every time some industrial revolution has come along, everybody says, oh, well, we're going to lose all our jobs. Well, there's going to be new jobs. There's always going to be somebody to fix these machines. There's going to be people to program these machines. There's always going to be industries that we haven't predicted that have to go along with these the robots or any type of industrial upgrade. It may not be the same job. It may not be the person putting in windshields, which has been replaced by robots at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're going to see new things rolling out, and if we don't see that, then we're going to see a collapse in the economy because no one will be making any money.
Sam Fiorani, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll talk again very soon.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Yeah, you got it. You know, the other part in this too, then, is I think your guys are right. With the change, there is just other job opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have maybe the person screwing on a lug nut on a vehicle, but at the same time, you're going to potentially need
programmers,
whatever, maintenance systems in place.
Yeah.
My question then is, are we ready for that transition? Mm. Are there enough of those workers out there now to then take those jobs?
And maybe, you know, should workers be getting prepared?
Well,
we have seen
a shift towards the trades.
Yeah.
And part of that equation would be skilled trade workers that have the ability to work on these machines. The other part of this, too, is right now the UAW has about 370,000 active paying members in the country. Go back 20 years ago, it was 538,000 active union paying members.
Yeah.
So in the span of 20 years, they've seen their base drop.
Their membership drop.
And the concern here for the UAW, whether you agree with the UAW or not, just from the UAW's perspective is, well, hold on. Are those programmers and engineers and, you know, those folks, are they going to be under the UAW umbrella? Or are they going to be hired in by the car companies
right.
to work in these factories. Mm-hmm. That's where the UAW's got the biggest issue with all of this.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the UAW has been around for years. They see their membership dropping because of this. And then, as Sam just talked about, in China, you go into those plants and you don't see any workers.
Right.
It's mostly robots. Are we getting to that point?
Coming up on the other side, we're talking, these things are absolutely everywhere now.
Oh, the e-bikes.
Everywhere.
I rode an e-bike in California one time on Venice Beach. It was pretty cool.
Pretty fun?
Yeah.
All right, we're talking about them next. It's JR Morning. Have you seen e-bikes?
I've seen a lot of them.
Moving around?
Recently.
I'll tell you, like in my neck of the woods, it's like they're like little gangs of kids with e-bikes, and they just drive around. They're in the grocery store parking lot. And they're over here bebopping around, and they're driving around.
They're everywhere, man.
They are absolutely everywhere. I mean, even in Rochester, people are the city is weighing a proposal to regulate bikes, e-bikes, and motorized devices on certain downtown sidewalks to create a pedestrian safety zone.
Mm-hmm.
So it is more of a prevalent thing. They're much more available now. I remember, boy, when I was a kid, I must have been in fifth grade, sixth grade, something like that. I remember my one of my buddies, his dad worked for Ford.
Okay.
And they created some sort of e-bike.
Oh.
And he got it as like a prototype or whatever. And we were driving around the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it was fun. I mean, they are a lot of fun.
We were in California when my family was on Family Feud, and we were taping, and we were out there, you know, just hanging out, and we were at Venice Beach, and they had the e-bikes, and so we all just, you know, jumped on the e-bike, rented the e-bike. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, but there does seem to be an issue with them, because there's a lot more of them, first of all, and people are driving them all over the place. Andy Rohrer is the executive director of the League of Michigan Bicyclists and joined us this morning to talk about it. Andy, good morning. It's good to have you.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're good.
We're well. Let's talk about it. The e-bike issue has blown up. Why is it such a hot-button issue?
Well, I think the reason it's a hot-button issue is that it's a case where technology has exceeded our ability to regulate or legislate. Because, you know, we do those things, you know, slowly and deliberately, we hope. And
slowly, the key word there.
Yeah.
It is slow sometimes, I can tell you that. And you know, really what's happened is it's, you know, they've just expanded. There's a lot of them around now, and there's lots of different types. And I think there's, you know, a lot of confusion, but let's bring it back to really what we're talking about is e-bikes are bicycles. And I think what you guys are talking about with a lot of the young folks, a lot of parents are buying their kids something they think is an e-bicycle, but it's actually a motorcycle.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize, Andy, that there are different classes of these e-bikes. Kind of help us understand the differences. You got a class one, class two, class three bike.
Yeah, so a class one, let's just break it down to what an e-bike is. Basically, all three classes have to meet at least three criteria to be considered an e-bike. They have to have a saddle or a seat for the rider, pretty basic stuff. The motors cannot exceed 750 watts of assisted power, meaning it's an assist. And 750 watts is roughly akin to 1 horsepower, so pretty low powered. And they have to have functional pedals. A class one e-bike has assist only up to 20 miles per hour. Class two is assist only up to 20 miles per hour, but also can include a throttle. So it still has pedals that work, but it also has a throttle. So the operator can just power it with the throttle, but it will not exceed 20 miles per hour with that throttle power. Okay. And then, of course, a class three e-bike provides assist up to 28 miles per hour, and it has some restrictions. Class three e-bikes may not be operated in Michigan by anyone younger than the age of 14 years old. And if they're 18 or under, they must be wearing the helmet. So there's only a helmet requirement on class three, for juveniles.
I want to go
anything
back.
Anything that exceeds.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say any device, two wheels, electric motor, if it has a motor with 751 watts of power or more, it is not an e-bike. Under Michigan law, that is a motorcycle, and now it falls under other rules. It's considered a vehicle. It needs to have certain DOT safety equipment, horns, lights, mirrors. And if it doesn't have those things, it's not road legal. And, of course, if you're operating on a public roadway, license, registration, and insurance are required as well.
Right. I do want to go back to the idea of regulation and legislation here. Why are so many communities struggling with this?
The short answer is that at the state level, there are no clear rules on electric motorcycles. There are extraordinarily clear rules on what an e-bike is, what qualifies as an e-bike. There are very clear rules about gas-powered or internal combustion engine-powered mopeds, motorcycles, quad cycles, etc. But these electric motorcycles, place in the law or in the regulation right now, where they're not properly defined or they're not adequately defined, and it's really leaving law enforcement in the lurch, if you will, because each of these departments, each of these municipalities is trying to deal with the problem on their own. And a lot of law enforcement don't actually fully understand what their, you know, kind of what tools they have at hand. Although they do have some tools at hand, they're pretty draconian. A lot of it comes down to writing tickets to the minors, writing tickets, which can have impact on their driver's licenses later, writing tickets to the parents, seizing or impounding these vehicles. And, you know, that's kind of a tough place. And so what the municipalities are doing, you look at what happened in Dearborn Heights just a couple of weeks ago, South Lyon, East Grand Rapids up on the west side of the state. What's happening is the municipalities are taking matters into their own hands because the state legislature has not.
Interesting. Something that we're going to continue to keep an eye on. We know you will too, Andy Rohrer. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, folks.
Yeah, you got it.
And, you know, while you do have critics of the e-bikes, you have those who support e-bikes saying that, you know, it gives older adults and people with disabilities and less experienced riders, you know, an opportunity to stay active and, you know, and get out of the car and do more and be more active. So that's the other side of e-bikes. But, you know,
yeah,
something that's going 28 miles an hour doesn't necessarily need to be on a crowded trail with walkers and families.
That's you're hauling.
Yeah.
You're hauling.
Yeah, that's all, yeah.
Hey, I'm excited for this Thursday because nearly two dozen lawmakers, former intelligence officials, researchers, whistleblowers coming together for a UAP disclosure and implications forum.
Boy.
It's called Disclosure Forum 2026. It's happening in D.C. The theme, Humanity at the Edge of Discovery. U.S. Senators Kristen Gillibrand, Representatives Eric Burleson of Missouri, Tim Burchett of Tennessee, all participating. Leading scientists in this issue as well, physicists.
Okay.
Get your popcorn ready.
I know you are ready for that.
I need it. I need it like I need air to breathe. Coming up, 7 o'clock hour, we'll get you caught up on the headlines. Matt Hall scheduled to join us this hour as well. Until next, the JR Morning.
Oh boy. Oh, we gotta let people in on what's going on.
I gotta tell you, of all the great stories coming from the World Cup, this is one of them.
Oh god.
One of my favorites. So obviously people have been flocking to the United States to watch the World Cup.
Sure.
Right? People from all across the marbly globe that we all live on.
Yeah.
They're all here. And we talked a little bit this last week as I was trying to sell you on this tournament.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you were.
Did it work?
Yeah, a little bit.
No. The answer is no. Lloyd continues not to care. And that's okay.
I still watch 5 minutes on Saturday.
Right, before
the lottery numbers flash on the TV. Then I turn it off.
Well, they have gone to Bucky's.
Uh-huh.
They've been going to Walmart and Costco and Waffle House and Old Country Buffet, and they have been traveling all around and eating our wonderful food. First of all, I think they like the food. You know why they like the food?
Why?
It's because there's so much crap in it.
Oh, well.
They don't have that there.
No.
I saw one guy at a store, and he's like, look at these Fruit Loops. This is unbelievable. I'm buying these. Uh-huh.
Oh, because of the colors and all that? Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's why they like the food so much, because it actually... they taste good.
They also like ranch.
They like ranch.
They found out that.
So this is the thing that is becoming the thing. It's ranch. And people have been trying to take bottles, multiple bottles of ranch dressing back to their home country. So much so that the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, is reminding travelers not to pack bottles of ranch in their carry-on because they exceed the 3.4-ounce liquid limit.
You can take 3.4 ounces back with you.
TSA on social media said that there have been repeated ranch incidents at airport security.
Oh, my God. Out of all the things.
Out of all the things we have to offer.
Like I said in the break, somebody over there could probably figure out how to make ranch.
Oh,
dressing,
dude.
It's the
Sure. Buttermilk over there is probably incredible.
Somebody could be rich. Whoever makes ranch
yeah,
over
right.
there.
Okay. You know? The most popular person over
I'm
there.
Telling
yeah.
you.
But hold on. They haven't had Jets Ranch, and they haven't had Leo's Coney Island Ranch.
Yeah.
Oh, true.
Those are, I mean, you want the pinnacle of ranch dressing.
Oh.
That's it.
Yeah.
And isn't anything somebody else makes better than what you make yourself?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, yes, of course.
If you can make it for me, this is the best ranch dressing ever. I have the mixed buttermilk and all that. Oh, this
but
is
what do you? But like, my question is: are these people going into just a grocery store and leaving with Kraft ranch?
Yeah. I have seen pictures of people from England standing in the grocery aisle where all the ranch dressing is, pointing at the ranch dressing like they're next to a monument or something. it's like. Look at this guy. He's so happy to be standing next to ranch dressing, and I just walk past it every day. It's weird.
I wonder in these cities where you got, you know, these games going on from, you know, the World Cup, you got grocery stores who have a shortage of ranch.
And, probably.
You know?
See, but again, but this is why I'm not surprised, like, the English like it, because when they dip their chips, right, their French fries, in they dip it in, I believe, mayo.
Yeah, mayonnaise is what they use for French fries over there.
So they're already getting like a creamy, you know, deal with their chips.
Sure, sure.
So I'm not surprised that they like it. You get that creamy base, and that's what you're into.
Okay.
But it is the ranch dressing that is making all the waves here.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty funny.
President Donald Trump endorsing John James in his campaign for Michigan governor, calling him an America First candidate who will deliver results for the state. In a Truth Social post, the president praised James as a West Point graduate, combat pilot, Iraq War veteran, businessman, member of Congress, saying he has a complete and total endorsement and will not let Michigan down. Now, Trump said James would focus on cutting taxes, reducing regulations, boosting domestic manufacturing and energy production, strengthening border security, supporting veterans, and protecting gun rights. James, who represents Michigan's 10th congressional district, thanked Trump on social media, saying the endorsement is energizing his campaign and pledging to lower costs, improve public safety, and increase election security.
It's a huge endorsement for John James. And as a result, we saw Eric Nesbitt bow out of the race. He suspended his campaign for governor.
He's done.
His
name will still appear on the ballot.
Correct.
He's done.
Correct. And he is now supporting John James.
He's endorsed
John James.
Yeah.
Look. The question is whether that's going to be helpful or not. Certainly during the primaries, we have seen that Donald Trump's batting darn near 1,000.
Yeah.
I think he's had a couple blemishes.
Just a couple,
On his endorsement record.
Yeah.
But there is no doubt that for the primaries, that is going to help whoever that is. In this case, it's John James.
Yeah.
It's when you get to the next stage.
And
it's when you get to a
And you're running against your opponent. Yeah.
Correct. That's where... We don't know yet.
Is that Trump person strong enough to take it past November?
And that's where quality of candidate matters. Mm-hmm. It's where your messaging matters. It's where fundraising matters. It's where the perception, the polling of you matters. That's when all of that will,
and that's where more people are paying attention. Because, you know, I mean, let's just face it. You know, during the primary, you just don't always have a lot of voters. People are still vacationing. They're out with their kids. They're doing things. They're not paying really a lot of attention. The attention really gets paid to that November election.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. And again, for John, it's a big get.
It's a big deal.
It's a big get. And I wasn't it ML Elric we had on last week or the week before. I don't know. I'm sorry, it all blends together. you can check out the interview on WJR.com.
Yes,
but one of the things that he wrote about in the Detroit Free Press was everybody was jockeying for Donald Trump's endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Perry Johnson's out here with the 47-47 campaign.
Oh yeah,
right. You know, Eric Nesbitt has been active in trying to get Donald Trump's endorsement. John James certainly has.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those factors play in here, and John James ends up with the endorsement, and we're already seeing Republicans line up for their support.
Quickly, you surprised about Dusty May?
Dusty May leaving Michigan to go to Dallas to be the head coach of the Mavericks in the NBA. I'm surprised, and I'm not surprised.
Okay.
I'm a little surprised by the timing.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised that Dusty May is getting immense interest from the NBA and wants to go coach in the NBA. Yeah. Just coming off a national title.
I mean, come on. Your stock is high right now.
His stock is high, and when you've got a roster of good players,
yes.
I mean, you see what he can do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they lost less than a handful of games this year, and they were a juggernaut.
Yes.
So, yeah, I see why he's a very appealing candidate. He's got to pay, what, $5 million to the university as a buyout?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But yeah. You're just shifting money around
at
that
all.
Point.
That's yeah. It. That's
yeah. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. A couple of days ago, we were busy celebrating our beloved fathers on Father's Day, and in the process, we set a spending record. Sales, while not yet a final tally, are expected to reach a record $27.9 billion this year, according to the National Retail Federation and Proper Insights and Analytics. And this record-breaking number marks an increase from the previous record of $24 billion set last year. In line with previous years, an estimated 77% of consumers celebrated Father's Day this year, and on average, consumers spent $226.58 on their dads. That's up from a previous record of $199.38 in 2025. And of course, the most amazing thing, despite ongoing economic uncertainty, spending was clearly brisk. 45% of consumers purchased a gift for a father or stepfather, followed by a husband at 25%, sons at 13%, brother 10%, friend 8%, and grandfather 7%. As in the past, greeting cards are the most popular gift for Father's Day, with 60% of consumers making that purchase, followed by clothing at 58%. National Retail Federation Executive Vice President of Strategy Phil Rist had this to say: while nearly every gift category saw an increase in spending this year, electronics and personal care items had the largest gains. Where we do all this buying this year? Well, we've made the most of our purchases online. 38% of the purchases, to be exact, were made at online e-commerce sites, followed closely by purchases at physical brick-and-mortar stores at 37%. Now look, the economy may be challenging us, but nothing is going to stop us from honoring our loved ones and celebrating them, and this year's Father's Day sales make that clear. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business, and that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Well, for more than 35 years, Michigan State University's LeFrak Forum has been the place where students can debate concepts of political life or civic education or political philosophy. And it's important because as we approach the 250th mm-hmm. of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and this big old grand experiment that we call the United States of America, the idea of what is the pursuit of happiness? What
yeah.
is that ever enduring, ever long perspective of what that means? And that's the topic that the LeFrak Forum is going to focus on now. And Raul Rodriguez is the director of the LeFrak Forum and the assistant professor of political thought inside the Department of Political Science at MSU and joins us this morning. Professor, it's great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Obviously, everybody's got something planned for the 250
yeah.
and how they're celebrating or looking back, examining where we are at this point in our history. Why was the pursuit of happiness the correct theme for your forum this year?
Well, you know, for us, because we are focused on political philosophy, we thought that the pursuit of happiness would be a fitting topic within the celebration of the 250th of the Declaration, because that question of happiness is a difficult question. It's not an answer that we can easily come up with. We all inevitably live out some answer to that question, but we often don't take the time to think about that. And what political philosophy is good at is trying to illuminate the problems. And at MSU, within the LeFrak Forum, we don't want to give students the answers to that question. We want to help them think for themselves and to really examine the authors who have thought about that question the most. And so we go back to the Declaration of Independence, but we also go back to the entire history of political philosophy.
And, you know, Raul, many young people today, you know, they're dealing with social media and economic uncertainty, and we got all this political division, and we got AI. You know, does that make the pursuit of happiness a little bit more difficult than it was for previous generations?
Yes, it makes it a whole lot harder. And what's even more difficult about it is that it appears that it's easier, right? A lot of young people now, they have a lot of opportunities. They can go anywhere around the world. They could imagine living having any job that they want. With AI, they have a whole new technological power that we've never had before. And so it seems like things are wide open. And yet there's a real paralysis among students because they don't know how to choose what career they want, how to use the power that's been given to them. And so, you know, the forum really wants to help students kind of guide them and allow them to be able to think for themselves by going back to the great authors of the past.
You know, I as forward thinking as Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Ben Franklin were, I don't think they expected Grok at some point or ChatGPT, right, things like that to muddy the waters a bit. How has this idea, this pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, how has that changed? How have you watched that change in your students over the years?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that I think is sort of a perennial problem is that, you know, a lot of times we can get easy answers to things. We can rely on certain tools, on our certain authorities to give us answers to things. And you see this a lot with students now because AI, I mean, it makes being able to write a college essay, you know, much easier. You can just plug things in. And so it makes it harder for them to think for themselves. And that's always been a problem. It's always been difficult for you to learn how to think for yourself, but even more now with AI. And so that's one of the things that we've really been trying to work on in the classroom is confront students with these fundamental questions and allow them through open debate with each other to think about these questions. And that's kind of where we start. Now, of course, there's all kinds of other dilemmas that AI is going to open up. And I can't even start to think about how to answer all of those questions. But I think if we can teach students to know themselves first and foremost, I think that's a good start.
You know, some students, Raul, struggle with America's founding documents because of the nation's history of slavery and discrimination. How do you encourage honest conversations about those contradictions?
Yes. I mean, I think the most important thing is to go back and to the debates and the records, because I think there are a lot of times lots of perceptions of the way in which the American founding, the Declaration of Independence, or the Constitution, how those were crafted. And of course, there were all kinds of debates and sort of moral dilemmas and ways in which there were compromises made that are sort of somewhat of a tragic stain on our history. But nevertheless, there have been figures, you know, people like Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, that have shown us that, you know, these original documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, they're great liberty documents. And in fact, the ways in which Jefferson and other people wrote these documents in such a way so that people in the future that came about could use them to get rid of slavery, mm-hmm. and to make it be a bulwark against tyranny. And, you know, reading authors like Abraham Lincoln and others, I think students come to see a more nuanced position. Now, it's important we don't try to whitewash anything. You know, we want students to see the unseemly aspects of all these dilemmas and writings and the way in which the history of slavery in the United States. But we just really want students to be able to look at the facts and to go back and to read these documents for themselves and the debates surrounding them.
Mm. Really interesting topic for your students to mull over and chew over, and putting a spotlight on the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and what these documents, these living documents, mean for us. Really impressive stuff. Raul Rodriguez, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. And best of luck on this forum, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Look forward to coming back.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think it's an interesting forum to have. It's interesting topics.
Yeah, and I think it almost doesn't matter if it's the 250th celebration of our anniversary or not.
Right. Yes.
These are the almost the philosophical questions and debate that you can have in a controlled setting where it's not meant to be combative.
Exactly.
Where it's meant to be constructive and you try to learn and grow and have a better grasp on what we are and what we have been and what we will be into the future. I think it's fantastic that MSU is doing this.
You know, I wonder sometimes, you know, if Thomas Jefferson and Abe Lincoln and Frederick Douglass were sitting around a table today discussing the pursuit of happiness, what would that discussion be like?
Well, I'm just going to ask Rock, and we're going to see what that...
You're going to put
Rock,
it in chat.
What makes me happy? Coming up on the other side, House Speaker Matt Hall joins us. He's got a topic on hospital pricing. It's next. All right, so House Speaker Matt Hall has introduced a sweeping package of bills that would drastically lower hospital costs. It would also target the nonprofit status of these healthcare systems, and it would create a state-run hospital cost review board with the power to oversee pricing and approval or denying of rate increases and even scrutinize hospital finances like revenues and expenses, executive pay, things like that. There would be major changes to hospitals here in the state if this piece of legislation were to go through. Let's talk about it with the good Speaker of the House, Matt Hall. Good morning, Mr. Speaker. It's good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about where this idea came from and why was now the right time to bring it forward?
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of people across the state, and whether it's, regular people or small business owners or, you know, all kinds of people, they're saying one of the biggest problems they're facing are healthcare costs. You see the healthcare premiums have gone up, you know, it's like 30% a year. People are paying more out of pocket for their healthcare. And one of the drivers of that is the hospital costs. You know, we saw recently that big dispute that was going on where Michigan Medicine was trying to raise their costs by like 40%. So, you know, it's one of the drivers is the cost these hospitals are charging. And so I started looking at what other states were doing. And I saw in Indiana, which is a nearby state run by Republicans, they came up with a similar idea to this. So I started looking at it. We had to make some changes because, you know, state laws are different. But the idea is if you're a nonprofit and you're getting, you know, you do not have to pay sales tax and you do not have to pay property tax, then you shouldn't be gouging people with your prices.
Mr. Speaker, hospitals argue that, you know, these proposals could threaten their financial stability. You argue that they would lower costs. How do you balance that affordability with keeping hospitals financially healthy?
Yeah, well, the idea is, you know, because there are for-profit hospitals like the DMC, and they would not be affected by this legislation. But most hospitals are nonprofits. They don't pay sales tax and they don't pay property tax, but yet they're raising their costs considerably every year. And what we're seeing is, you know, very high paid executives. We're seeing all kinds of expansions and mergers. And what the mergers were supposed to be lowering costs, but what we found is that's not the case. They're increasing costs. So under the hospital review board that we came up with, the only way they can merge is if they lower costs. They have to lower their costs by 2%. And then they have to, you know, we don't let any one hospital system have more than, you know, 8% of the statewide market share because they're getting too big and then they're raising prices.
Mm. I do want to talk about what this board would mean. Who would serve on this board? I mean, generally, like, I tend to fall on less government oversight, smaller government, things like that. Does this give the government more control over these hospital systems or just their pricing? Like, what role would they play?
Yeah, so it's appointed by the legislative leaders and the governor. Each legislative leader would have an appointment, and the governor would have an appointment. Five people total on the board. And the idea is to have access to all of the financial information of these hospitals, and then to prevent hospitals from raising their rates above the rate of inflation. But even if they raise their rates by less than the rate of inflation, they'd still have to get approval by the board. Now, the reason that I look at that is, you know, every year we give billions of dollars to hospitals, and every year hospitals are coming to us saying they have no money, and they're raising their costs, and they're expanding, and they're buying up other hospitals, and they're paying their executives millions of dollars. So I'm looking at this saying, like, we want hospitals to be financially solvent, but the prices keep going up. So we're just looking at it saying somebody has to look at the books here, and to stop these increases if they're not financially needed. And that's what this hospital review board would do.
What about rural hospitals that are already under financial pressure, Mr. Speaker? And we've recently seen Sturgis Hospital announce plans to close. Could additional regulations make it harder for these smaller hospitals to survive?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing we've been working on for the rural hospitals is the rural health care funding under the rural transformation plan that was passed in the working families tax cut at the federal level. And, you know, Governor Whitmer could have applied to get funding for the rural hospitals and chose not to. And, you know, we had one of the worst applications of any state in the country and left all kinds of rural healthcare funding on the table. And so, you know, what we're pushing for is for Governor Whitmer to resubmit our rural healthcare application and try to draw down more funding for our rural hospitals. Now, under our system, the board that I am proposing, you know, if they, you know, what we would do is the nonprofit hospitals, they have a choice. If they want to gouge people and continue to raise their prices, then they can forfeit their nonprofit benefits. If they do that, then our legislation would take some of that funding and give it to the rural hospitals as well.
Mm. I do want to ask you just about the budget process. Late last week, you had made mention that you would consider directly negotiating with Senate leadership on the state budget. Have things fallen off with the governor at this point, and even some members of your of the Republican caucus in Lansing?
Well, you know, I called Vinnie Brinks. And I said to her, look, you know, the governor has been out of town all week. We're making no progress on the budget. Why don't you and I make a deal? And then we'll inform the governor of it after she's back from her trip. You know, Winnie Brinks, you know, thought about that. You know, I made an announcement. And then all of a sudden, Governor Whitmer's team was empowered to negotiate the budget.
Mm.
So, you know, we were on the verge of doing the budget without Governor Whitmer, and then Governor Whitmer's team came back to the table. And now we've been negotiating most of the day and most of the night to try to iron out some of the big picture items in the budget. And hopefully we'll have something to announce soon. You know, I'm really pushing to not allow any tax increases, do not allow them to raid the rainy day fund, and to make the budget smaller and more efficient than last year. And hopefully we'll have a deal very soon that does that. And then we've got to get our subcommittees to work to iron out a lot of the more fine details.
You think we make that July 1st deadline?
I'm hopeful that we can. I think we're close to having agreement on some of the bigger picture items, but I'm not going to allow the Democrats to raise taxes, take money from the state rainy day fund, and grow government. We need to be more efficient this year.
House Speaker Matt Hall, always appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Dusty May out at U of M, headed for the NBA. We'll talk about it next. It's JR Morning. So Dusty May out at the University of Michigan. He's headed to Dallas to head the Mavericks in the NBA. He gone.
He gone.
And what does this mean now for Michigan? Because, you know, you get to the point now where things have kind of slowed down on the basketball front.
They have.
College hoops, things have slowed down. Transfer portal, things like that. Everybody's mm-hmm. kind of picked their destination. And even some of the reactions from some of Dusty May's former players, current players, things yeah. like that. Yeah. So the big questions now are, A, who are they going to hire?
Mm-hmm.
And B, who are they going to be able to keep on their roster?
That's it.
Right, because now yes. you've all these guys have signed up to play with Dusty May, and of right. course money's involved in things like that, and guys are going to stay if the money's there.
And how does this, you know, how does this involve recruitment, getting people to come to U of M because they want to play maybe for Dusty May, but Dusty May is not there anymore.
Yeah, certainly, all these things are the main questions now for the University of Michigan, and you know the buyout and all those things.
Yeah.
Whatever, that's just money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's easy.
Just moving, you know, chips around.
I'll give you $5 million. Yeah, I'm going to collect this much on the other side.
Exactly.
I'm breaking even. Whatever.
It's all good.
Whatever. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Good. Yeah.
But, you know, for Michigan, you know, this is, I who was it? I think it was Dave Portnoy from uh-huh. Barstool. I saw a video of him yesterday,
uh-huh.
right after the news broke. And he said it in a very Dave Portnoy way. But I think the message was right, which is for Michigan, you know, they have been incredibly successful.
They have.
You know, a few years ago, the football team wins a national title. Mm-hmm. Now the men's basketball team wins a national title. And now what have we seen in both of those instances? Their head coaches are gone.
Are gone.
Afterwards. Now, yeah. Jim Harbaugh was a bit of a unique circumstance because he came from the NFL, wanted to come back and coach his alma mater, and then left.
Yeah.
Because he wants Super Bowl.
Exactly.
Get it. And he got to the mountaintop with his alma mater. Nothing left to do.
That's right. Right?
Understand, get it. Dusty May, it's the same situation. It's like you win the national title, you show what you can be as a coach, and now all of a sudden, you're going to the next level. You're going to the NBA now.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is part of what happens when you have success, especially in modern day college athletics.
Okay.
It's not like, you know, Coach Krzyzewski at Duke just did his thing for years and years and years and won and did his thing and he was fine. But now the landscape has changed, NIL, transfer portal, all that, and it's a different world.
Look at Izzo. Izzo's been at State. And
right.
He hasn't gone. And I'm sure he's been asked to go to the NBA.
He has. He's talked about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's talked about it. But here's the other part is, okay, it's a different world, but now you're going to lose some of these really good coaches.
You are.
To that next level.
You are.
So that changes the game,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the other thing I'll say. And it's actually happened with a bunch of college programs, but it happened with Michigan. I can't remember if it was their title run and then – and it certainly did happen this year, but I think it was on Amazon. They ran like a docuseries
uh-huh.
on Michigan football during the season, those things.
Okay.
Kind of like a what's that show called on HBO? Hard Knocks,
yeah.
Like for the NFL.
Uh-huh.
Very similar.
Okay.
They did one on Paramount Plus with Michigan this year, okay. leading up to the national title.
Okay.
So what you're doing now as a coach is you're also elevating your profile.
Absolutely.
You're giving
Absolutely.
These teams unfettered access into what you do to prepare.
Exactly.
What your yes. how you operate how behind the scenes.
And they're saying,
Yeah.
Yeah.
I go, oh, I kind of like this
that.
Guy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's very interesting because we're in the at the same time you want to win games, you're also almost as a coach in the process of if you have the opportunity.
You're auditioning.
You're auditioning without tampering. There's no tampering. Nobody's
right.
coming to talk to you.
That's right.
You're just going, hey, look what we do behind the scenes. Isn't
yeah,
that interesting?
It is. It is. But that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened.
And again, Harbaugh doesn't need to do that. Dusty does.
Yes.
Because Dusty's a lesser-known name.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Harbaugh was already there. People know.
Exactly.
So I think it's fascinating this
different
world
time,
that
man.
We live in.
It's just a different time now.
It's a different time, and I don't know that I love it. And to you brought up Tom Izzo.
Yeah.
Tom Izzo has been very clear where he stands on NIL and the transfer portal.
Yes, he has.
He hates it. And I don't blame him. I don't blame him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he says, are we serving the students? Are we serving our student athletes if we just if we're just allowing them to go wherever they want?
Yes.
Part of this process is like you make a commitment, you go through the trials and tribulations, you hit some bumps in the road, and then hopefully at some point you reach your goals and you become a better player.
And you stick with it and you continue. Yeah.
And that's Tom Izzo's modus operandi. That's how
he gets down. This is how he works. It has been.
But it's proven to be good for
sure
for the program, the university, for the players that have come through there.
Yes. Yes.
So there's more than one way to skin a cat. But at the end of the day, you're going to have different perspectives, and that's fine. We are just in a different world. It's a different era.
Yeah.
And now Dusty May's gone to the NBA.
You know what, though?
What's that?
We got that natty. Thank you, sir.
I know.
Yeah?
No, if you're a Michigan fan, I don't think you can be that upset.
No.
No.
Yeah, you know, only that we got 2 years with a really good coach, but at the end of the day, you got that natty, man.
You got the natty, yeah.
Yeah. But again, this idea of, like, this is what happens when you reach that level in today's college athletics. You get to that point, and these guys are going to go, you know what? I don't want to do it. I don't want to have to go out and try to woo somebody to the program with a wad of cash. I don't want to have to not only try to recruit players through the NIL avenue, but then now I still got to go to high schools. Cool. I can see where that's exhausting.
And it's just nice to just be able to just coach and get your check.
Yeah, and now Dallas leadership goes, oh, so Dusty had, you know, 3 first-round draft picks on that team. We know exactly how he's going to be able to coach with high-level talent.
Yeah. No, I mean, now, there is a little difference because that high-level talent in the NBA is getting paid a whole lot of money, and they got egos and stuff like that.
For sure.
You got to be able to deal with that part of it.
For sure. And that's not something you overlook.
No.
But again, if you're able to take that talent and elevate them even further, you feel good about what you're doing. So I don't know. I find it fascinating. Plus, we got the NBA draft tonight.
We got the draft, yeah.
Which I'm excited about. I don't know what the Pistons are going to do. I've seen Filon. Yeah. I've seen them trading up to get Yaxel Lendeborg, speaking of Michigan. I've seen a bunch of different
rumors. Well, they want to keep the core, and they just want to add somebody that can help the core. You know?
I do kind of get the feeling, like, I would not be surprised if Isaiah Stewart gets traded.
Really?
Yeah. That's kind of the vibe I get.
Well, who would we get?
I don't know.
Okay.
It could be a part of a package to move up in the draft.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
But it seems like there's a lot of smoke around that. Now, whether it happens, I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea. I have no insider knowledge. But it just seems like there's a lot of smoke around that rumor.
Okay, well, we'll go check that out. Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, 8 o'clock hour, get you caught up on the headlines. Also, Senate hopeful Mallory McMorrow joins us at Share Morning. Awesome night downtown last night.
Seems like the weather was perfect.
Weather was perfect. Took the family down to the Ford fireworks. Hats off to Tony Michaels and his whole crew. I mean, it really was a perfect night. And the fireworks, Zambellis were awesome. I mean,
you always wonder, like, how do they outdo themselves after a show like
that? It's a good question.
And they do it, though.
Every year. Every single year.
They do it.
It's spectacular. And just to see everybody, you know, there is awesome. You look across the river to all of our Canadian friends and family. They're all there ready to rock.
Oh, man.
You have the helicopters bring over the Canadian flag and the American flag on a flyby.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
No, it's a big deal, and we do it big here. And I know your kids are now spoiled. They can't, you know, no other
fireworks display is adequate. Like, we went to one, we go to the Ford fireworks, and then we go to another, you know, whatever. We run into them every once in a while.
Yeah. Like
yeah, and they're like, pfft. Like, this stinks.
What is this stuff?
I'm like, hey, man.
What are these sparklers?
It's nice. Yeah. We didn't even have to come.
No, but once you see the Ford fireworks.
It's different.
I mean, you feel the concussion.
Oh, yeah.
Hit you.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was funny. So I haven't even responded to my mother. She texted me last night and goes, is Detroit still standing?
Yeah,
watching it on Channel 4.
Oh wow!
I mean, it was something. And they do. I was telling the kids, I'm like, wait for the finale.
Finale is always.
It was crazy. I mean, we parked on the, I guess, what is that? The north side of the Rensen.
The Rensen. Okay.
And so we were having a good time at the parade company's event. And then I was like, we got to go back to the car.
Uh-huh.
We parked in a parking structure on the water. So we had a view
right at the
water.
And
I said, and I go, we got to get back there because I got to get up early.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to boogie as soon as the fireworks are over.
Yeah.
So we went back there and we were watching it. And so we're in a parking structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that final firework lit after the finale, all you hear was, I mean, there must have been a dozen or so car alarms that were set off.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic night. Meanwhile, big news from Donald Trump yesterday. He's weighed in on the gubernatorial race.
And not really surprising. He has endorsed Republican Congressman John James and his campaign for Michigan governor. He called him an America First candidate who will deliver results for the state. Now, the president said James will focus on cutting taxes, reducing regulations, boosting domestic manufacturing and energy production, strengthening border security, supporting veterans, and protecting gun rights. He said in a Truth Social post that he praised James as a West Point graduate, a combat pilot, an Iraq War veteran, businessman, and member of Congress, saying he has complete and total endorsement and will not let Michigan down.
Certainly big for John James. Donald Trump has a good track record in these primaries.
It's a big deal for John James. Not so much for Eric Nesbitt, who has suspended his campaign for governor just hours after the president endorsed John James. Nesbitt from Porter Township announced on social media that he's ending his bid and joining Trump in backing James for Michigan's next governor, calling for party unity heading into November.
Yeah, and there has been a coalition around John James. Now Eric Nesbitt, it was Tom Leonard that had suspended his campaign and hopped on board John James's train. And so we are starting to see that coalition of support for John James.
So you still have on the Republican side, Attorney General Mike Cox and businessman Perry Johnson, who are still in the race.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be impactful for John James for fundraising, certainly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and he's going to attract a lot of dollars as a result of this.
Mm-hmm. Also, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers is demanding that Democratic hopeful Abdul El-Sayed stop calling him a pharma lobbyist and alleging a $14 million payout or face a defamation lawsuit. Now, in a letter from Rogers' legal team, El-Sayed is ordered to cease and desist from making the claim, which Rogers says is false and damaging to his reputation. Rogers says he has never been a registered lobbyist and calls the accusations a whopper of a lie. El-Sayed, a candidate in a competitive Democratic primary, has repeated the criticism in national interviews, arguing Rogers benefited financially from the pharmaceutical industry and has taken large donations from it. His campaign says the claims are based on Rogers' financial history and political record, while accusing Rogers of trying to silence him ahead of the general election. Rogers' attorney are demanding a response by today, escalating tensions in what is already, you know, shaping up to be a pretty closely watched Michigan Senate race.
Yes. And one of the things that Mike Rogers told the Detroit News, his web of lies might work in a Democratic primary, but I learned as an FBI agent, you can't let people get away with it. That's why today I'm putting Abdul El-Sayed and his campaign on notice with a cease and desist.
Mm.
So it's getting contentious already. And you know what's interesting about Abdul El-Sayed? He is acting like he is the guy.
Oh, yeah.
He is acting like he is the candidate here that is going to run against John James, which I find interesting because you still got to get through the primary.
You do.
And it certainly has become heated on the Democrat side of things as well. Meanwhile, yes, Dusty May out at the University of Michigan. Now the attention turns to A, player retention, and probably A, finding the right coach.
Yeah.
And then B, player retention.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly makes a good job a little harder.
Yeah, our universities are dealing with some things. I mean, we're looking
for a lot of turnover.
A president and a basketball coach at U of M, and we're looking at it for a president and an AD
yeah.
at Michigan State.
Yeah.
Got a lot of stuff happening here.
A lot of stuff happening. Plus, we're still waiting on an investigation from the University of Michigan into their athletic department
that's
as well.
Right.
Which apparently is completed. But we haven't seen that yet.
Gotcha.
So we still are waiting on the release of that. I've been loving the World Cup. Lionel Messi scored again.
All-time
leading scorer.
This guy, man, they're calling him the GOAT.
Yeah.
This guy is no joke. I have to say.
I love that you're just coming to this.
I
love it.
I watched a little more than 5 minutes like I usually do on Saturdays.
Did you watch the U.S.?
I did watch the U.S., man. I mean, I have to watch our people.
In spurts.
I have to watch the U.S.
They're a fun team.
I'm telling you, man.
They're a fun team to watch.
They're exciting. And just, like I told you before, what I love about the World Cup, I mean, the games are fine, but it's the people. The crowds, the folks who are cheering, they are rabid about their team. They're just rabid about the World Cup to me. I just love watching them.
I think we should create a new segment on things that you're just getting hip to.
I mean, I always
you're
knew
like,
that
man,
they
this
were.
Messi guy is good.
No, but he is. I mean, I had to give it.
I love it.
I have to.
I love it.
Give credit where credit.
We should
due.
Do that. We should do that with all of us. Okay. Me, you, and Jamie, if we come to something that we have never encountered before,
that should be
the new segment. It's like when people from Europe find ranch dressing.
Oh, that's another thing, yeah.
These people from all over the world that are here are trying to bring bottles and bottles of ranch back in their carry-on, and the TSA's like, guys, that's too much liquid.
No, 3.4 ounces.
You can't bring that much ranch in a carry-on. Could you imagine the scene in an airplane if those bottles exploded?
Oh, God.
The smell of buttermilk and dill or whatever it is. Oh,
can
my
you imagine
God.
What the garbage cans look like at TSA? That they've thrown all this, unopened ranch bottles in a
just
garbage
can. It's just they have a whole different facility for the disposal of Hidden Valley.
So what I'm hearing from Lloyd is if I need some free ranch, I might hit up the airport.
That's right. That's right.
That's the way to do it.
That's right.
Just as long as they have a refrigerator, keep
just,
the refrigerator.
Just go stand right outside TSA. You don't even need a ticket there.
No, you don't.
Just
I
say,
can't take that on. I'll take it from you, sir.
Just hold the sign.
You got the stuff?
Any ranch?
Briefcase full of ranch.
We'll accept ranch.
They'll be like, hey, take it. I just got this garbage can full of ranch over here. You might as well take it. We're just going to throw it out. So, hey, here you go.
Michigan Democrats are proposing restrictions on data centers. State Senator Mallory McMorrow next on JR Morning. Democrats in the Michigan Senate have unveiled a new package of legislation aimed at data center developments, and it's regulating these centers. They say they want tech companies to come to the state, but they have to take steps to protect the environment and residents. And obviously, the data center issue is a big one. And talking about it with us today is State Senator Mallory McMorrow, also running for U.S. Senate here in the great state of Michigan. Senator, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Good to be back.
Why now the time to come out with these regulations for data center development? We've seen states across the country kind of reap the benefits of these massive centers. Why should we more heavily regulate these and look at them more with a cautious eye?
Look, I can tell you that all of our constituents across our districts, and this is happening on the aisle, are raising the alarm about feeling like data center development is happening too quickly, that it is too often happening to communities instead of with communities. So our package of bills would create the strongest data center regulations in the entire country, ensuring that Michigan residents' energy rates won't go up, that the data center companies would be required to bring new renewable energy onto the grid for all of us to benefit. It cannot harm Michigan's air or water, must use local labor and deliver real tangible results for the community so that if this is something that the community wants, it is done on the community's terms, not on these tech companies' terms.
And I was going to ask you about that, Senator, because the bills require community benefits agreements, and critics say that could slow down or discourage investment, but supporters say it ensures that you get that local buy-in, that local consent. How do you respond to that trade-off?
So we're building in language that would put some time limits on the amount of time required for, a contested rate case, for example, to be put in place. But there are companies who will have billions upon billions of dollars to invest in building out data rights, and they should be required to be good community citizens. And we also want to remove NDAs, so make sure this is not done in secrecy. The community should have a real seat at the table here and ensure that it benefits the community.
And so what's the next steps in this bill? Is there support in Lansing for this?
So it's been really exciting. We introduced these bills last week. We've seen the governor come out in support of the legislation, and even Republican Speaker Matt Hall saying that he is open to taking a look at it and knows that we need to do something to regulate data centers. So this feels like one of the few issues right now where it cuts across party lines. Michiganders are increasingly calling out for legislators to act here, and we're proud to be at the table.
I know Senator Jim Runstad is calling for a one-year moratorium on data centers altogether. You see that as responsible or caution or overreaction to the new technology?
I think that's an overreaction from the state level. There are some municipalities across the state who are implementing their own moratoriums, and if that is right for your community, you should. There are some other communities who do see the windfall and the benefit of bringing in some of these companies. And from the state level, we don't want to put our thumb on the scales for what is right for the community. We want to give community leaders the tools they need to ensure that they have the support to do this properly.
So if Michigan should set the terms, as you put it, for these data centers, how do we balance the regulations with making sure? I mean, we've seen, for example, chip companies that were heavily looking at Michigan and those plans didn't materialize. So how do we stay competitive in these projects and that these companies don't go, all right, well, Michigan is a roadblock and now we have to go somewhere else?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, the project that you're referring to was the SanDisk chip facility that was hopefully going to receive a large CHIPS Act award that was created under the Biden administration. Donald Trump came in his second presidency, and right off the bat, he was critical of the CHIPS Act program, and the company said that due to the uncertainty of that funding in particular, they were no longer going to come to the state. So the way that we're looking at this is if we can put these guardrails in place right now, it gives companies what they need more than anything else, which is consistency. You will know the rules of the road. You will know how to engage in the state in the proper way. And if we do this right from the state level, it will actually speed up the timeline for decision making and make it clear how to do business in Michigan without that inconsistency that too often plays.
You're also a candidate for U.S. Senate. So does that kind of change how you approach an issue like this where you have environmental and economic and political concerns all kind of intersecting?
You know, what has been great is I've been campaigning now across the entire state for well over a year. So being able to bring that perspective into even developing this bill package where I'm hearing from Michiganders all across the state. I'll give you an example. I was at a building trades breakfast, and there was a guy who said, you know, he's going to benefit from these data center builds out. He's excited about the job and the job security. But he asked, how do I know that the thing that I'm building won't be used to surveil me and my family and won't be used to drop bombs in other countries? That is a heavy, heavy question, which is why on my campaign on the federal side, I rolled out comprehensive AI policy to talk about AI and job disruption, AI safety, because it's not just the data centers, it's what the data centers are for. And it's been really cool to see that the campaign has given me the ability to talk to more Michiganders in a way that I think informs this bill package to meet this moment.
I'm curious to know what it's like from your perspective and being a part of one of the most high-profile primary races in this country. Obviously, a three-way race for you on the Democratic side ahead of the primary here in August. What is that like? Where do you feel like you stand? We talked to Steve Mitchell, for example, last week and this week about the poll that showed that you were 6 points behind. Your campaign pushed back against that. Do you feel like that's where you're at this point, or do you feel like you're much more in the race?
Very much in the race. We're really excited. We're actually up on TV with our first ad today. And especially in this primary, the entire country is watching. And I feel like there is sort of a false bias with Abdul Ahmed. You've got a candidate who promises a lot of big things, who has never won an election before. And then with Haley Stevens, you've got somebody who's backed by Chuck Schumer, who still takes corporate PAC donations, who isn't doing any public events. So there's either this idea that you have to accept the status quo or take a risk on somebody who's never done it before. And with our ad up today, I'm introducing myself to so many voters to say, there's a different path. I'm somebody who has won tough elections. I've built real power, and I know how to do the job. And, you know, this data center package is an exact example of that. So we got 6 weeks left, and I'm going to go win this thing.
Are you going to take any days off during that 6 weeks? Any plans to go to Traverse City, hit a beach, anything like that?
Maybe a half day to do my laundry.
Right, you know.
Running all the way through the tape to make sure that, you know, I got clean socks.
Something's got to keep going.
Fair enough.
That's right.
Fair enough. State
That's
Senator
right.
Mallory McMorrow, we appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. But it is. It's a sprint now.
It is.
I mean, it's getting down to crunch time.
It's in the home stretch, baby.
And again, like being a part of a race like this, right, whoever comes out on top is going to be, you know, they're going to have a lot of support behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is going to be a coalescing, I would imagine. But it's not, I mean, there's a little bit of bad blood in this.
Oh,
in this Democratic primary.
It's which, drama.
Which I think adds to the intrigue.
It does.
Just from a spectator's perspective. I enjoy it. Coming up on the other side, Matt Hall, the Speaker of the House, joins us. We are talking potential funding and defunding for hospitals. It's next. All right, so House Speaker Matt Hall has introduced a sweeping package of bills that would drastically lower hospital costs. It would also target the nonprofit status of these healthcare systems, and it would create a state-run hospital cost review board with the power to oversee pricing and approval or denying of rate increases and even scrutinize hospital finances like revenues and expenses, executive pay, things like that. There would be major changes to hospitals here in the state if this piece of legislation were to go through. Let's talk about it with the good Speaker of the House, Matt Hall. Good morning, Mr. Speaker. It's good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about where this idea came from and why was the right time to bring it forward?
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of people across the state, and whether it's, regular people or small business owners or, you know, all kinds of people, they're saying one of the biggest problems they're facing are healthcare costs. You see the healthcare premiums have gone up. You know, it's like 30% a year. People are paying more out of pocket for their healthcare. And one of the drivers of that is the hospital costs. You know, we saw recently that big dispute that was going on where Michigan Medicine was trying to raise their costs by like 40%. So, you know, it's one of the drivers is the cost these hospitals are charging. And so I started looking at what other states were doing. And I saw in Indiana, which is a nearby state run by Republicans, they came up with a similar idea to this. So I started looking at it. We had to make some changes because, you know, state laws are different. But the idea is if you're a nonprofit and you're getting, you do not have to pay sales tax and you do not have to pay property tax, then you shouldn't be gouging people with your prices.
Mr. Speaker, hospitals argue that, you know, these proposals could threaten their financial stability. You argue that they would lower costs. How do you balance that affordability with keeping hospitals financially healthy?
Yeah, well, the idea is, because there are for-profit hospitals like the DMC, and they would not be affected by this legislation, but most hospitals are nonprofits. They don't pay sales tax and they don't pay property tax, but yet they're raising their costs considerably every year. And what we're seeing is, very high paid executives. We're seeing all kinds of expansions and mergers. The mergers were supposed to be lowering costs, but what we found is that's not the case. They're increasing costs. So under the hospital review board that we came up with, the only way they can merge is if they lower costs. They have to lower their costs by 2%. And then they have to, we don't let any one hospital system have more than, 8% of the statewide market share because they're getting too big and then they're raising prices.
Mm. I do want to talk about what this board would mean. Who would serve on this board? I mean, generally, like, I tend to fall on less government oversight, smaller government, things like that. Does this give the government more control over these hospital systems or just their pricing? Like, what role would they play?
Yeah, so it's appointed by the legislative leaders and the governor. Each legislative leader would have an appointment, and the governor would have an appointment. Five people total on the board. And the idea is to have access to all of the financial information of these hospitals, and then to prevent hospitals from raising their rates above the rate of inflation. But even if they raise their rates by less than the rate of inflation, they'd still have to get approval by the board. Now, the reason that I look at that is, you know, every year we give billions of dollars to hospitals, and every year hospitals are coming to us saying they have no money, and they're raising their costs, and they're expanding, and they're buying up other hospitals, and they're paying their executives millions of dollars. So I'm looking at this saying, like, we want hospitals to be financially solvent, but the prices keep going up. So we're just looking at it saying somebody has to look at the books here and to stop these increases if they're not financially needed. And that's what this hospital review board would do.
What about rural hospitals that are already under financial pressure, Mr. Speaker? And we've recently seen Sturgis Hospital announce plans to close. Could additional regulations make it harder for these smaller hospitals to survive?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing we've been working on for the rural hospitals is the rural health care funding under the rural transformation plan that was passed in the working families tax cut at the federal level. And, you know, Governor Whitmer could have applied to get funding for the rural hospitals and chose not to. And, you know, we had one of the worst applications of any state in the country and left all kinds of rural health care funding on the table. And so, you know, what we're pushing for is for Governor Whitmer to resubmit our rural health care application and try to draw down more funding for our rural hospitals. Now, under our system, the board that I am proposing, you know, if they, you know, what we would do is the nonprofit hospitals, they have a choice. If they want to gouge people and continue to raise their prices, then they can forfeit their nonprofit benefits. If they do that, then our legislation would take some of that funding and give it to the rural hospitals as well.
Mm. I do want to ask you just about the budget process. Late last week, you had made mention that you would consider directly negotiating with Senate leadership on the state budget. Have things fallen off with the governor at this point and even some members of your of the Republican caucus in Lansing?
Well, you know, I called Winnie Brinks. And I said to her, look, you know, the governor has been out of town all week. We're making no progress on the budget. Why don't you and I make a deal? And then we'll inform the governor of it after she's back from her trip. You know, Winnie Brinks, you know, thought about that. You know, I made an announcement. And then all of a sudden, Governor Whitmer's team was empowered to negotiate the budget.
Mm.
So, you know, we were on the verge of doing the budget without Governor Whitmer, and then Governor Whitmer's team came back to the table. And now we've been negotiating most of the day and most of the night to try to iron out some of the big picture items in the budget. And hopefully we'll have something to announce soon. You know, I'm really pushing to not allow any tax increases, do not allow them to raid the rainy day fund, and to make the budget smaller and more efficient than last year. And hopefully we'll have a deal very soon that does that. And then we've got to get our subcommittees to work to iron out a lot of the more fine details.
You think we make that July 1st deadline?
I'm hopeful that we can. I think we're close to having agreement on some of the bigger picture items. But I'm not going to allow the Democrats to raise taxes, take money from the state rainy day fund, and grow government. We need to be more efficient this year.
House Speaker Matt Hall, always appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
In 1946, Detroit-style pizza was born at Buddy's. With a square steel seasoned pan and handcrafted double stretch dough that's layered with margarita pepperoni, covered corner to corner with Wisconsin brick cheese, and topped with classic sauce, this is the pizza that started a style.
Started a style,
oh my goodness.
Today we celebrate the 80th birthday of Buddy's Pizza.
That style continues, people.
Pizza Day in Michigan, National Detroit Style Pizza Day. And when you're talking Detroit-style pizza,
yay!
Obviously, it is Buddy's. And Dave Wentrack, the area manager with Buddy's Pizza, is here. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Chris.
And Adam Targansky is the COO of Born in Detroit. Adam, good morning.
Hi. Good to see you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. First, I want to talk a little bit about how you celebrate an occasion like this. And there's a really cool partnership, and you're wearing one of the shirts that are awesome.
Yeah, we're partnering with Born in Detroit. You know, we're gonna have our team's all dressed up, you know, because, you know, Buddy's Pizza started a style that was born in Detroit, so it's just a natural partnership to be with a great brand like them.
And let me just say a happy 80th.
Because, well, thank you so much.
Like I said, you know, there are restaurants that are not open for 80 days.
Right.
But closing. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
It's a tough business.
Is 80 years, and they're still here. And what is that mean to you, and not just to you, but to your to the workers and some who have been there almost 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great honor for me, you know, and I love seeing the team's pride in it. And like I was telling you off air, yeah, employees that have been here 40 years making our dough and making it right and putting out great product. So we're excited to, you know, we have some promotions that celebrate that. Like, you know, former employees can come in today and get 25% off. You know, and Buddy's has been with generations who have grown up on it. So if you come and dine with three generations of your family, we're going to get you 30% off. If you come in with four generations of your family, we'll get you 40% off today.
And Born in Detroit, I mean, you're I love the style.
Thank you.
I absolutely love it.
Thank you so much.
And when it came to this partnership, how did this partnership begin?
Well, I mean, first, it's a no-brainer. There's few places that you could ever say is more of a Born in Detroit company than Buddy's. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, if they're coming here, whether they are a tourist or whether they're returning home from somewhere else, you're going to Buddy's at least once.
Yeah.
Right? And with the familiar relationship that the rest of the owners have, mm-hmm, with the new owners of Buddy's, hand in hand, no way we could turn that down. It's iconic.
Sure. Yeah, it's something interesting about food and fashion, both, you know, being identity, you know, markers when it comes to this. Why do you think Detroit connects so strongly to brands that represent lifestyle and culture?
I mean, I think as a city, we're very proud of our what has been built in our city, whether it's from the automotive industry, you know, the first traffic light, mm-hmm, you know, to
Motown
music. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We plan to be cranking up the Motown music at our stores today.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, you know, not just our normal mix of music.
Yeah.
To kind of celebrate another Detroit icon like that as well.
And the original store is still there on,
absolutely,
6 Mile and Conan.
6 Mile and Conan. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It's like it's a remnants of an old house that was turned into a speakeasy, then into Buddy's Pizza. And it's just a wonderful store. And, you know, you're talking about people coming from the air, like making their trips here. One of my visits there was a family coming in with their luggages from McNamara Terminal.
Uh-huh.
Like, that was their first stop from landing in Detroit. They Ubered to 6 Mile.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
How close is the pizza today that people would get on the 80th birthday of this great establishment? How close is it to the original pie that was made 80 years ago?
Oh, it's so very close, because we're using fresh ingredients. You know, there's no preservatives. It's still, you know, double stretch dough, you know, all natural.
Yeah.
You know, no sugar or anything in our dough.
It's pretty cool.
And, you know, we were saying, you know, if you had openings for taste testers, you know, that we would be game. You know,
well, I mean, we were talking to the day in the break, and Dave's like, well, yeah, I got to try the pizza every day.
Right.
What a laborious gig that is. Right.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's like when I go to tables and it's just like, yeah, it's like, well, I love the pizza and they pay me to eat it.
So right.
No, that's right. Exactly.
It's great.
Do you have a favorite? What's your go-to?
My go-to is it's a more of a build-your-own, pepperoni, ham, onion, and green pepper. You know, kind of a twist off our super pizza.
Solid.
That's pretty classic.
Yeah, and solid.
Tell us about the pepperoni one that we had this morning.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a specialty.
Yeah, it's a special deal for our 80th anniversary. It has 80 Old World pepperonis on it to mark the occasion, and it's going for a special price of $19.46.
Wow.
So just in honor of our, obviously, start date of 1946. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a dollar from each of those pizzas is going to go to Detroit Pal. So it's
cool. That's even better.
It's great pizza, great cause.
That's awesome. Do you guys count the pepperoni when you put
Absolutely.
Them on? Do you really?
Yeah. Yeah, I did my 8 rows. And eight by 10, you know, when I was building it this morning, I'm like, okay, 6, 7, 8, that's rough, you know.
Pretty good.
Got to make sure, because, hey, people will count them.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, right, exactly. You don't want 72 on there.
Right, exactly.
That would be a
nightmare. No, that's not right. That's not right. The shirts, will they be for sale soon?
We are working on it.
Okay.
We do plan to have these Born in Detroit shirts in our stores that people will be able to get. So.
Just in the stores? Are they going to be in your store?
I don't know if we worked that out specifically, if it's going to be available at
just
any of our brick and mortar.
At Buddy's.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Apparently above my pay grade.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. But you will eventually be able to get them at Buddy's.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. And if not, there's always BornerDetroit.store. I'm sure we could work out.
Yeah.
Figure
it out. Because they're very cool. It's a black shirt. It's got the red lettering with the kind of yellow accents.
Mm-hmm.
A 1946, Born in Detroit, a 1946 original. Buddy's logo below that, and then the Detroit skyline.
That's just
that.
A nice boy. If you're going out of town, going to another state, going somewhere, to have that shirt on, man, it just
You're walking around. Right. Somebody just go, Buddy's.
Buddy's.
Exactly. I love Buddy's.
Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you, I was in Italy last year, and I had like a Detroit Tigers quarter zip on, and we're at the Amalfi Coast, and some guy's like, "Hey, go Tigers!"
Oh yeah.
You know, so if I was wearing a Buddy shirt, they'd be like, let's go.
People see it, you know, and if you want to see what the shirt looks like, come to one of our locations today. The team will be decked out.
There you go. Boom. That's how you do it.
Celebrate 80s with us.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, first of all. It's a huge accomplishment. Like you said, being in the restaurant industry is not an easy venture.
It's not.
But it is a testament to what you guys have done for so long, that you've built, you know, people that love your food, and then you do it well and consistently.
You so much. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's very cool. Dave Wentrek, thank you so much. And Adam Targansky, appreciate you both for coming in today.
Right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Very cool. 80.
80, man. I'm going to tell you. And that pizza still tastes good.
Tastes great. Well, I mean, we had to try it for quality purposes.
That's it.
We can't come on the air and lie to you.
No, we can't.
So we had to do our due diligence, our research, and can't confirm.
Exactly. And there's more due diligence to go.
That's exactly right. All right, that's going to do it for us. Kevin Dietz and All Talk coming your way next here on WJR. Have yourself a wonderful Tuesday, and we'll see you tomorrow.